Hello and a very warm welcome to Central Stage. Great to have you with us. Now, tomorrow is Arba'in, 40 days after the martyrdom of Imam Hussein, the anniversary of the martyrdom of Imam Hussein. A very unique and amazing figure who actually lost his life and life of those who supported him, all his family members and those close to him in the event of Karbala. So our hearts really go out to Imam Hussein and, of course, all those who followed him and martyred on that fateful day. Now, the success of Muslim Brotherhood, Egypt's presidential elections, Egyptian-Israeli relations, Syria's already violent uprising becoming a full-fledged civil war in 2012, and its significant spillover effect on its neighbours, plus rising Islamophobia in Europe and in the USA in 2012, with insulting American movie and French magazines, printed cartoons are some important and thought-provoking developments we'll be discussing in this first in a two-part series of programs called 2012 in Review. Hello again, great to have you back with us. Now to discuss these extraordinary developments, two top guests join us today. Now here in the studio, we have the pleasure of being joined by a well-established and professional journalist. Mr. Hamid Golpira, it's a great pleasure to have you with us.
Thanks for having me. I'm happy to be
great.
Here.
Now let me just tell you that Hamid Golpira is a top writer working with Tehran Times. Some of his articles have been translated into several languages, including, of course, German and Russian. Hamid is also working for Press TV. Now, over the phone from London, hopefully in a couple of minutes, we'll be joined by a well-established journalist, Mr. Spin Tanai, who is actually a presenter at BBC World Service and an established political analyst and professional journalist. Now, time for a short break, but after the break, we'll be discussing the first half of the most important and thought-provoking developments in 2012.
The year 2012 was most certainly a quite tumultuous year full of unexpected and sometimes quite unbelievable developments. Center Stage in a two-part series of programs, including this week's program, tries to investigate the most significant and at the same time thought-provoking global developments affecting the world in general and the world of Islam in particular. In January 2012, the Muslim Brotherhood mobilized its supporters and won 47% of the parliament seats. In April, as Egypt prepared for its presidential elections, the Supreme Presidential Electoral Commission disqualified 10 candidates from running for president, including the Muslim Brotherhood's chief strategist, Khairat al-Shater. Eventually, in June, Supreme Presidential Electoral Commission announced the Muslim Brotherhood's candidate, Mohamed Morsi, as the winner of the country's presidential runoff. Mohamed Morsi received nearly 52% of the votes, with over 13 million ballots, becoming the country's first freely elected president since the ouster of the longtime dictator Hosni Mubarak. This is while the former Egyptian Prime Minister Ahmed Shafiq won over 12 million votes. However, the voter turnout was a slim 51.85%. Another thought-provoking but at the same time disappointing development of last year seemed to be yet another part of the ongoing project of Islamophobia. Those undertaking the task of profoundly misrepresenting Islam tried to once again target God's last prophet. Muslims in all corners of the globe were outraged by the blasphemous video made in the United States that tried to disrespect Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him. It's fair to say that the worldwide reactions to such insulting moves clearly demonstrated that there's no room for such extremist moves to stir up racism and hatred in today's world. At the same time, it makes us ask ourselves whether all such moves are coordinated efforts or even a joint ongoing project to disrespect the world's fastest growing religion as well as the world's best creation.
Hello again, great to have you back with us. Now, we're talking about the most important developments in 2012. And of course, this is the first in a two-part series of programs called 2012 in Review. Now, the success of Muslim Brotherhood, the previously banned entity, was quite extraordinary in 2012, wasn't it? In January, the Muslim Brotherhood mobilized its supporters and won 47% of the parliament seats. And it repeated its victories through the year 2012 up until last week, when the constitution was eventually approved in a referendum. So the success of Muslim Brotherhoods, despite, you know, all the suggestions that it may prove otherwise, what was a fact. And we, you know, Hamid, we see that also when it comes to constitution, there were lots of opposition, but despite that, the constitution was finally ratified.
Well, yes, indeed, that was the case. And it is a significant point for 2012 that the Muslim Brotherhood had all this success in Egypt after this, you know, getting on, I think, like 70 years or something or more, 80 years of trying to get to somewhere, of trying to get to somewhere. Now they finally got to somewhere, but now it's extremely important that they, you know, that they really, you know, feel the which way the wind is blowing, understand the population, because like everyone maybe doesn't want to have something exactly like what they want, so they have to like, you know, they have to figure out something that like at least satisfies a reasonable amount of the people and not just 51% of the people, because if you satisfy 51% of the people, it can also mean you don't satisfy 49% of the people. That's not a good, you know, that's not a good sign for the future, you know. You can't maybe satisfy 100% of the people, but at the same rate, you know, it should be more than 51% of the people satisfied. You can't have 49% of the people dissatisfied. So somehow they have to present things. They have to make a system that will bring at least more people in, that people will at least be somewhat happy with the system.
But you know, the thing is, Hamid, you're mentioning that to satisfy 51% of the people, I think it's 51% of the people who actually took part in the voting process.
Okay, so then you could say if I don't know, I forget how many didn't vote,
It's been about 30%, you know, turnout in the constitution.
Well, see, that's also not good.
32,
I mean, 70% didn't vote. So if 50% or 60% of 30% is 18% of eligible voters, that's not the greatest thing.
But you know, I'll put that question to a number of, you know, representatives.
Yeah, I heard it actually. They're saying it only matters who votes. But then again, the same people, I don't think they're being so straightforward, because the same people, when 20% of the people voted in elections for Mubarak and 80% said we don't vote, they didn't say that's democracy.
Right.
Mubarak got one half of 20%. They didn't say that. So I don't know what kind of an expression is it, because not to vote or to cast a soil ballot, there's all different kinds of things that are happening in democracy, or it could also be something that you know, yes or no is not, maybe the people want maybe, or they want a third choice or something.
Right.
Like it's not all of us, or the candidates on the thing, it's not all of us, like these are all the choices. Mm-hmm. You know, it could be the candidate they want, or the party they want, or the choice, or the referendum choice they want is not there.
Great.
So there's various reasons why people don't vote or cast a soiled ballot or something like that.
So the Egyptian society is still very polarized.
Well, it is, yeah. Well, and it's probably going to remain reasonably so to a degree. But they say what the Muslim Brotherhood has to figure out now is that, like, okay, how are the people thinking? Mm. A lot of people are not so religious. You know, I myself, I'm religious. I'm for Sharia. I'm for this. But at the same rate, if a lot of the people are not 100% for that, or not so much at all like that, again, it matters how you interpret it. I'll tell you, this will be a defining thing. It's actually a defining point for 2012, and it will be a defining point for the future. And you see it in some other issues that, like how are people going to interpret Islam? They want to interpret it like the Taliban or some other, like every little mistake, we must harshly come down on every slightest sin. We must be stiff and intolerant, and that's only going to help the enemies. That's going to turn people away from Islam. Or we're going to have a little bit more tolerant kind of Islam. You know, not lax, but just, you know, more tolerant, more understanding of the slightest little sin doesn't require the heaviest hand to come down on, because that only helps the enemies of Islam, that turns people away from Islam.
Excellent.
Now, if the Muslim Brotherhood can understand that, which I think some of them do know what's going on, whether they can put that into practice, I think some of them know what that is. then maybe they can at least bring on board, or even somewhat on board, some of the people that are a little bit more secularly minded or less religious or something, because that's a fact of the current population, the demography of today's Egypt. I mean, even in the country is something like 10% Christian, okay? They shouldn't all be dissatisfied, even if the country is whatever, 90% Muslim. It shouldn't be that they're all dissatisfied. If people treat them in a reasonable and fair way, they will be at least somewhat satisfied. Because you just don't want to have endless discontent in the society, and that's what they had for the three decades of Mubarak.
And we know that a number of people are apathetic. They're probably not very much, inclined towards politics, and that's why we have low.
But it's not all apathetic. I think that's a wrong interpretation. You can't tell me that's like saying 80% of the people were apathetic when Mubarak was having his elections and 19% voted. The 81% was really no to Mubarak. So it was 81% plus the... That's what it was. It wasn't apathetic, so Mubarak should win. I mean, the argument of these people is that Mubarak should have been in these fake elections with one candidate with 19% of the people voting. I mean... Yeah, it's not all apathy. Some are apathy. Some are something else again, in my view.
Thanks very much indeed, Hamid, for that. Now, we are now, of course, joined by our other top guest over the phone from London, Mr. Spintanai. Mr. Tanai, it's a great pleasure to have you with us.
Thank you very much. Good evening. In London, we have evening. I don't know what time is there. But anyway, good evening to everyone.
Thank you very much. It's actually very early in the morning here in Tehran. You can call it also the evening because it very much looks like an evening. So we'll put our first question, which is also about Egypt, after this short break to our top guest, Mr. Spintanai, after this short break. So please do stay with Central Stage. Hello again, great to have you back with us. Now, let's move on to April. In April, as Egypt prepared for its presidential elections, the Supreme Presidential Electoral Commission disqualified 10 candidates from running for president, including, of course, the Muslim Brotherhood's chief strategist, Khairat al-Shata. Now, after its first candidate was disqualified, the Muslim Brotherhood had to do something. So they basically nominated the relatively unknown Mohamed Morsi. And it's probably interesting to know that he was mocked in Egypt as the Brotherhood's spare tire. Nonetheless, Morsi seems to have been able to exploit the Muslim Brothers' strong grassroots network and highly organized team, and Mr. Tanai emerging victorious on many fronts.
Well, I think now we are looking at different Brotherhood party in Egypt, actually, because what happened was that the mistrust that people have had before towards the Muslim Brotherhood, because people usually, even in the Muslim wars, they were a bit skeptical because they were thinking that, you know, Sayyid Qutb and Muhammad Qutb, and after that, when the theory came to, in the Egypt, and they were, as you know, even in the modern time, they were banned by the government. So people were thinking, even in Islamic world, that they are fundamentalist parties. But when you look at his actually initiatives and what he's doing now, we can see a different Brotherhood and a different leader of the Brotherhood. So that's why, in my opinion, he is in a way changing the strategy of the party and taking the party into a modern party, modern Brotherhood that is not connecting in any way with extremism and fundamentalism of Islam. So that's why I believe there is their success. And in my opinion, the leader of the party, Morsi, had played a great role in that. And he was, he has a good relationship even with countries that few months ago it was difficult to say that he will have those kind of relationship. So that's why, in my opinion, the Muslim Brotherhood of Egypt, especially their leader, Mohamed Morsi, if not just the case that he was accused of, having more power, because, as you know, the famous decree of power that he was taking that power to himself. Right. If you just deduct that one, otherwise I think he is successful leader of the Brotherhood.
So your assessment of his performance is quite positive, isn't it?
I think so, because the Brotherhood is, they are in power now, and it is a new party, and the skepticism of some people toward this party was really an issue. Mm. But now we can see that it is a different party, and it has a different leader, and in my opinion, he is actually stepping ahead in a positive way.
Right. But, you know, when we look back on what happened a couple of weeks ago, we actually see that you refer to the decree, and we probably see that what he did probably polarized the Egyptian society even further, didn't it?
But again, in my opinion, he is a leader that he can see, you know, he has a broad vision. And in my opinion, if you look at those kind of things in many countries, when things happen like this, the escalation is higher and higher, because the leader is sticking to his idea, and the parliament and the, let's say, other pole, I mean the other side of the conflict, sticking to their side. So that's why the conflict become more visible. But in Egypt, in my opinion, it was, again, his wisdom of the movement that he went to compromise. And he said, okay, he's happy with what, the other side is pressing for. And that's why, because he was accused of many people in Egypt and elsewhere that he is, you know, taking power, and he's becoming the president that who wants to have more and more power. In a way, some people were looking as a dictator. But if he went to that path, which is compromise, which means that he was not sticking to his, you know, pressure that he was putting. In my opinion, it was, again, the step forward for reconciliation in Egypt, and that's why the conflict was avoided.
Right. You mentioned that probably there were a number of countries, the relationships with whom was considered to be quite impossible. Probably you're talking about Israel. And I'd like to, talk about Egyptian-Israeli relations for a moment, if you don't mind. We know that Israeli Prime Minister, Israel Prime Minister's office at the time said, basically after the Brotherhood's candidate won the election, that Israel expects continued cooperation with the Egyptian administration on the basis of the peace accord between the two countries. So would the new Egypt continue to agree to continue peace treaty with Israel, do you think?
In my opinion, they will. You know, the thing is that in the region, I don't think that the policy that was during the Hosni Mubarak times, because Egypt was the country which was seen friend of American, and also with Egypt, with Israel, they had not bad relationship. That's why, in my opinion, he will continue, and also because Israel in the region, they don't have friends among the Arab countries.
Right.
That's why they are expecting to have some friends among those countries in the region, and that's why they are accounting for the Egypt to be one of their friends. And that's why, in my opinion, it is not the reverse policy, but they will continue to have a good relationship with Israel, in my opinion.
Thanks very much indeed for that. Now, Hamid, we were talking there with Smetana about the, you know, Israel-Egyptian relations, and probably that's one of the most controversial issues that people have been talking about since the Egyptian revolution began. What we actually see at the moment, to be honest, is that the peace accord is continuing to exist, and there are probably what we expect, or some segments of the population expected to happen, is not happening.
No, I think a lot of segments of the population don't want to have relations
I do apologize. I think there is a problem with no, it's okay. There was a problem with your mic, but now it's okay.
Okay.
No, please continue. Sorry.
Anyway, I think
a large part of the population of Egypt is against these relations with Israel. But at the same rate, like, they have to do things. Look, I don't think they will just break off and toss all these Camp David.
Okay, Hamid, I do apologize again. I think we need a short break for your mic to be fixed. So if you don't mind, I'll have to put the question to our other guest, and then in the break we'll take care of that.
All right.
Okay. So. Right, so as you understood, we'll have a bit of a problem with the mic of Hamid. So we'll take a short break after the break, hopefully with a newly functioning, with a full functioning mic. We'll be back. Thank you very much. Hello again, great to have you back with us. Now we have Hamid's mic up and running again.
Okay. So I'm going to go back
about,
to that. Yeah,
right.
Okay. We can say, well, yeah, I don't think the population of Egypt, the masses of Egypt, don't want Egypt to have relations with Israel, or especially they don't want warm relations. And so, but I don't think at the same rate that the new government and Morsi, the Mohammed Brotherhood, they will just immediately cut things off or something. But I think they will slowly gravitate away from, you know, the, I mean, even now, it's not like this, the relations that Mubarak had with Israel at all. And they will slowly but slowly gravitate away, maybe not without some sudden thing, unless some event happens that pushes that. But I think they will slowly gravitate away from that. Whether they formally say, okay, we're out of the Camp David hordes or any of this other stuff, I don't know if they will say that. But maybe they won't say it in order to appease certain Western countries. But then in practice, at the same time, you know, they won't, you know, they won't be having such friendly relations at all with Israel.
There have been a number of tensions over the last few months in Israeli-Egyptian relations.
And then Gaza borders Egypt, and Gaza was even a territory of Egypt for some years. I mean, if they had wanted, they could have claimed Gaza as their own territory. I mean, it was their territory till 1967.
Right.
So,
and what's your assessment, Hamid, of the role that Egypt actually played in bringing, you know, the truce to reality between, the Gaza Strip and Israel?
It seems they played some role. I don't know all the subtle details, what they did behind the scene, but it seems they played some role, if not, maybe not as significant as everyone says it is, but they did seem to play some role. At least they let their voice be heard. They let
their voice be heard. So are you saying that their role was not as important as everybody thinks?
Maybe it was. I mean, like I said, I think there was a lot of things going on at once there. It isn't like just everyone is suddenly going to listen to Egypt or Israel's going to listen to Egypt. It might have been some factor in decisions to, like, you know, de-escalate all this violence happening. But I mean, but there's, anyway, on a small to medium scale, not as big as that, there's almost constant violence in Gaza, in the West Bank, and these are occupied territories. So technically, even if it's a kind of peaceful day in Gaza or the West Bank or the occupied territories or East Jerusalem, so, you know, it's still under occupation. So, like, a peaceful day under occupation is a kind of violence, too. So, in the bigger picture, it's like so.
Great.
So, something must be resolved along those lines, you know. Something must be resolved along those lines.
So, thanks very much, Hamid. Great. Now, let's move on to another story which took center stage in 2012, and I'm sure that you and know that Syria was really an important issue throughout 2012. Syria's already violent uprising became a full-fledged civil war in 2012, and fighting in the conflict that had first erupted in March 2011 had been limited to certain parts of the country away from the largest population centers. Now, in July 2012, however, full-fledged fighting erupted in Syria's two largest cities, and, you know, Damascus and Aleppo, which is Syria's biggest city. Now, whereas at the beginning of the year, some 5,000 Syrians had died, according to UN officials, that estimate is now 7 to 10-fold greater, with the number of Syrians killed nearing 50,000. So it's a very shocking figure, isn't it? And Mr. Tanai, no mediation has so far worked. To quote Dr. Ismail Salami, Syria swings between hell and dialogue.
Well, I think the problem is in Syria that, in my opinion, the opposition within the Syria, they are not strong enough, because what the Western country, usually America and its allies, is want to put, you know, cards on the opposition. But opposition, they are not that much organized that someone expect them. And also the problem with the other side, let's say Bashar Assad, because the only friend that they have was Russian, and Russian also, they just back their, you know, they are not backing the Syrian government and Bashar Assad as they did in the past. So that's why. And also, when you see pictures from the television screens that people are dying, and usually this is happening from the government forces, because they bombarded even schools, you know. As we know, a couple of months ago, there was a school bombarded, and a dozen children was killed. I mean, the students from the school were killed. And when you see those pictures, And you see that there is no appetite for this kind of conflict from the international scene. And we don't see much of, you know, because as you can see that United Nations was pressing for it many times, and Akhdar Ibrahim, he was there in Syria, and the UN Secretary Kofi Annan, Ban Ki-moon was there. Mm. But in my opinion, no one is able really to solve the problem, and the reason behind is that the conflict is too complicated, and also there is not much appetite from the big power, if you want, if you like to say, from America and Russia and China, and that's why the new report of the UN says that nearly 60,000 people died from March 2011, and unfortunately, that's still continuing.
Right, you know, Mr. Tanner, when you look at the opposition, you also see that probably their actions cannot be justified either. I remember one, it was, I think, a footage of the opposition. I think it was broadcast on BBC World News and probably a number of other channels. That in one case, the opposition, they actually, had a hostage. They took hostage one of the, members of the Syrian army, I think. And then they used him as a bait when they wanted to detonate, a truck. So probably what is being done also on the other side cannot be justified.
Exactly. I don't think that it's exactly the fault of one side, but both sides are, unfortunately, they do not care much about the civilians. And especially when you see that the United States recognize the opposition as a legitimate, legitimate group or people of the Syrian people, So that's why it is, instead of calming situation, it's becoming more escalating, And
right.
Also the other countries, they follow the suits and they say that their position in the Syria, they are legitimate people that they will recognize as a, the people who fight for the freedom. But in my opinion, there were many cases that also the opposition, they are blamed for. Mm. So in my opinion, the conflict is escalating because the both sides, they don't take much care of civilians, and that's why innocent people dies. And in my opinion, the more the fearful situation is that there is no end to that.
Right. Thanks very much indeed for that. Now, we'll take a short break. After the break, we'll continue our discussion on one of the most important developments in 2012, Syria and Syria's full-fledged civil war. So please do stay with Center Stage. Welcome back. Now, Syria's civil war has had a significant spillover effect on its neighbours. The UNHCR estimates that more than 500,000 Syrian refugees have registered or are awaiting registration. Now, nearby countries, with the number growing by 3,000 daily, so these figures are really shocking, aren't they? Now, violence from the war has spilled across Syria's borders, with clashes occurring between Syrian and Jordanian forces, mortar and artillery exchange between Syria and Turkey, and also with mortar fire into Israeli-occupied Golan, triggering the first IDF, Israel Defense Forces, firing into Syria since the 1973 war. Hamid. So lots of developments when it comes to this spillover effect.
Well, indeed, lots of developments happening. And, well, in many ways, you could say this is kind of an out-of-order chaos scenario playing out. I mean, actually, people don't like people to talk about it, but, there is a Freemason, Freemasonic strategy of out-of-order out of chaos order. And they're creating a kind of chaos. Basically, in Syria, both sides and some of their allies, too, are falling into this situation,
right,
into this trap, and they're in many ways, not in many ways, in almost everywhere, they're basically, following the script, whether they know it or not, and what turns up in the future is, anybody's guess. It's not 100% clear where things are headed, but, in many ways, like what our other guests said here, too, there are problems on both sides. Both don't seem to be respecting civilians, and on I'm sure that the general population is not so satisfied with that either. I haven't seen any public opinion polls coming out of Syria lately that are authentic, but I mean, I'm speculating that like the people are not so happy maybe with either side, you know, and the third force is not emerging, or maybe there is something that's, you know, not coming out so much, but maybe a third force would emerge, and maybe that would be popular, or maybe all are trying to suppress that, you know, maybe the third force is what would actually resolve things and make something good, not just for Syria, but for the region, and that's something that's being suppressed.
Right. Do you think, Hamid, that we'll have to probably await a sort of momentous development in Syria anytime soon?
Oh, I don't know if it'll be that momentous, but I mean, things are going in some direction or other. Things will change. Things are not going to be like this. I don't at all think there's going to be years and years of civil war or conflict or something like that. It's probably not going to happen.
Time.
Something will happen. Right. Maybe not, you know, it might not be the resolution that everybody wants. It might not resolve maybe it might not resolve in a way that most people want it, but there'll at least be, I think, in relatively short period of time, at least a kind of lull in this storm, even if things later, the storm brews up again. But I think there will be a lull in the storm at some time in the near future, maybe in the next 4 to 6 months.
Right.
Something will come about.
So probably in the new year something will happen. So you don't think that... the same situation will continue over the course of the next year.
Well, it's not really going to be possible. I mean, you're not going to have a Somalia situation in Syria. I mean, there's a 1% possibility of it, but I don't think you are. I mean, we shouldn't really have, to tell you the truth, we shouldn't have a Somalia situation in Somalia. I mean, I don't really know why the Islamic world is not getting it together, or the rest of the world has allowed a Somalia situation to even exist in Somalia for all of these years, or an Afghanistan situation to exist in Afghanistan. But again, maybe this is more of this, you know, out of chaos order. Plotting, you know, so they create a certain amount of chaos in order to create another kind of order, a new world order, really, which will not be good for us and not be good for most of the people in the global south. So
great.
We should be aware of things.
Excellent. Thanks very much indeed, Hamid, for that. Now let's talk a little bit about rising Islamophobia in Europe and in the US, which has long been a big problem. And over the years, actually, Muslims have continued to be the focus of bigotry. And unfortunately, things didn't get any better in 2012 with the insulting American movie and French magazine's printed cartoons. In fact, some analysts believe that the problem of Islamophobia and insulting moves against the world's fastest growing religion and, of course, the world's best creation has intensified. So I think Mr. Tanai, it would be quite interesting to know who are really behind such blasphemous actions and whether these incidents are only a part of an ongoing Islamophobic project.
Well, in my opinion, again, from the both sides, there are elements that they want actually to escalate the situation from the side of the Muslims community here. For example, in London, if you see, they have Al-Muhajirun here who are really the people who are, in a way, fundamentalist Muslims. And if the rest of the society see them, because they pretend to be the representative of Muslims. So that's why the rest of the British people, they see Muslim as a fundamentalist. In fact, they do not represent the Islamic society in Britain.
Right.
And also, on the other side, you can see there were recent actually survey in Britain, and it says that Muslim are in Britain, they are not part of the problems in the society. So that's why people now realize that if a Muslim woman is wearing hijab in a London street or in elsewhere, it does not mean that they have that fear that they had a couple of years ago, or I don't know, 5, 6, 7, 10 years ago after September 11. So that's why, in my opinion, the people now, they have a different attitude and they have a different idea of Muslim. And my opinion, the Islamophobia that we've seen a couple of years ago, it's now less than what was happening previously. So that's why the people within the Muslim community, if they have more tolerance to that, I mean, if they are more tolerant, if something happened, let's say, for example, the movie of Muhammad that was actually played in America, And now everywhere in the Muslim world, there were different demonstrations. Mm-hmm. But if the Muslims people, they're behaving with the tolerance and they do not have right. this kind of, you know, violence demonstration, then okay. it will help to calm the situation, and it is in the benefit of Muslims to have more tolerance.
Excellent. Mr. Tana, we just have about less than 2 minutes to the end of the show, and I have one question that I'd like to put to both of you. So in 30 seconds, from your perspective as an established political analyst, what's been the most important and thought-provoking development in the year 2012?
What, in my opinion, the most important event was the re-election of Barack Obama in America, and that was because America is anyway it is a superpower, and mm-hmm. people have the you know their hope towards America, and we can see also the bill that it was actually approved today mm-hmm. about the spending cuts and the mm-hmm. taxes and so on. Yeah. It is a playing role within mm-hmm. the society, not in America but all over the world.
Great, thanks very much indeed for that. Now, what about you, Hamid? What do you think has been the most important?
Well, something
important
we didn't
about?
Talk about so much is this young girl Malala, who was shot in mm-hmm. Pakistan for mm-hmm. Standing up for women's rights and education for females.
Right.
And I think this
yes.
ties in a little bit together, like mm-hmm. other guests was talking about fundamentalists, they say she's shot by fundamentalists. In my interpretation, and mm-hmm. in a lot of people's interpretation, the fundamentalists of Islam say that women should get an education. Mm-hmm. And these guys against it are against the fundamentals. So mm-hmm. we must be careful about switching around the meanings of words. Mm-hmm. Like George Orwell's book 1984, like switching around the meanings of words completely. Mm-hmm. You know, the Ministry of Peace is the Ministry of War and all of this stuff. Okay, these fundamentalists are anti-fundamentalists. The fundamentals of Islam say everyone
Great.
Should get an education. And this is actually part of
Excellent.
A broader picture. Maybe I'm rambling on too much, but that we must, you know. Okay.
Thank you very much, indeed. Unfortunately, we are out of time. But before I go, I'd like to thank again my top guests. We had Sabine Tanai, presenter at BBC World Service, over the phone from London, and Hamid Golpirat, top writer and journalist working with Tehran Times. Thanks very much indeed for coming on, for talking to us, and of course for those insights. Until next week, from me, our guests today, and the rest of the team, it's goodbye for now. But before I go, I'd like to tell you that next week we'll be talking about the second part of the most important developments in the year 2012. So please do stay with us for that as well. Thanks very much indeed for watching. Thank you very much.
Thanks
Great to have you with us. Thank you.